Hello, all of you out there in Radio Land. This is KPTZ, Port Townsend, 91.9 FM. And for our virtual listeners, we hope you stay glued to kptz.org. Our website is more than just a way to listen to today's show. For example, you can find the biographies of all our hosts and DJs. You can also look up calendar listings to find out what's happening around town. You can even sample some of our earlier shows. Much of the original programming of KPTZ is currently right there for you to listen to as a podcast. You know, double your listening pleasure. Listen to today's show as well as some earlier ones. I'm Marianne McNellis. This show is called Our Town. Have you ever wondered who the people are that you see every day around the area? Who are those two dozen shirtless young men striding up Monroe Street the other morning? Lots of distracted female drivers were slowing down to enjoy the show. And who was that local yokel fisherman stuck in the sand at the boat ramp at Fort Worden? He was lucky that a park employee was nearby on his tractor. He pulled him out of the ever-deepening sand pit. And I now realize there's more than one bicyclist who's fashioned a cart so his pampered pooch can ride instead of trot alongside the bike. Those guys must have big hearts. My guess is that the pups in question are part of the AARP generation that makes up much of Jefferson County. Jefferson County is indeed full of individuals, strange and weird, some of them. And some of them are probably worth an entire book. This show, Our Town, is only a half hour long. It's definitely not long enough to do justice to some of the characters around here, but we do talk with people who make up the eclectic mix around the peninsula. We talk about their lives, their dreams, and how they ended up on the western edge of the continent, able to look across the Strait of Juan de Fuca, right at Vancouver Island, Canada. Over time, we'll be talking with firefighters and foodies, bus drivers and baristas, the lawyers and the ladies who lunch. We try to find out what makes them tick, what they think about living in beautiful Jefferson County amid the deer, the otter, and even the magnificent soaring eagles. Today, my guest is Ariel Spesser of the Northwest Justice Project. She's what's usually termed a public advocacy lawyer, someone who helps people with limited income in civil cases, such as foreclosure, child custody, or even sexual assault. She's also new to the Port Townsend City Council, but we'll get to that later. Welcome to the show, Ariel.
Thank you so much.
So I always like to start at the beginning. Were you born and bred in Port Townsend?
I wasn't born here, but I did grow up here. My family moved here when I was about 4 years old.
Okay, well, I think that counts as being a local girl. And did you go to the local schools?
I did. I went first to Swan School for preschool, then to Grant Street, then to Blue Heron Middle School. And then when it came time to go to high school, then at that point, my parents were divorced. So I did do high school elsewhere, but I always came back during the summers and all the holidays as my mother still lived in Port Townsend during that whole time.
Okay. What did your parents do?
My mother was the manager of the Port Townsend City Pool, and so she taught swimming lessons, synchronized swimming, swim team, water safety. And my father had a business called Foresight Science and Technology, still does, a self-employed business doing tech transfer work.
Can you explain what tech transfer is?
Certainly. It's the idea of marketing new and used technologies. And so a typical client could be anybody from a government agency, a university, a private inventor, to even a country. What my father does is does research about technologies that they either have or are inventing or are interested in acquiring, and then matches them with the technologies wherever they can be found. And this includes new technologies as well as repurposing old technologies.
Now, the other day when we were talking, you told me a cool example about submarines from World War II. Can you share that with our listeners?
Yes, absolutely. This is the best example that I use to kind of break down the idea of this tech transfer business. So one project that my father worked on was with the Department of Defense, and they have old submarines that are very valuable, but the technologies were outdated and they needed to sort of repurpose the submarine. So they were taking some of the technology out. One of the devices devices was this infrared laser beam tech that they weren't quite sure what to do with. After doing research, my father determined that up in Alaska, the Department of Fish and Wildlife had a need to determine the level of mercury in tuna because we want to make sure the tuna is safe. This particular technology could also be reapplied to determine that level of mercury. So the technology was then sold to the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and they were able to use it to meet their needs.
Wow, that is cool. You mentioned that your parents got a divorce and you moved back to the East Coast with your father. You were in high school then?
Yes.
And was that a real culture shock to go from Port Townsend to where was it?
We went to a town called Dartmouth, Massachusetts. It was a big culture change to go from Port Townsend, Washington in the Northwest to East Coast, New England culture.
Can you mention some of the specifics? What were some of the little minor but big difficulties you had?
The first thing was just the clothes that kids wear. Coming from Port Townsend, we would just kind of wear whatever. But on the East Coast, there were certain stores that were really popular, and there was a lot more consumer culture.
So are you saying that maybe you wore jeans and t-shirts to school and they wore dresses or blazers or what?
Yes. Yeah, that's a good example. Yeah. On the East Coast, it was very clear that there were certain stores like Abercrombie and Finch and The Gap. Mm-hmm. And if you weren't wearing clothes from those stores, you were kind of like, oh gosh, what's that girl wearing?
Did you end up fitting in?
I did. Yeah, I actually was able to kind of put a spin on it, really show them that it's okay to wear whatever you want. I was actually able to be quite successful in high school. I joined the sports teams. I played soccer and lacrosse and I ended up being like the captain of my lacrosse team. Did very well in school, had a lot of friends. And by the end of it, I think people really valued my uniqueness and it was something that was an asset, which was nice.
And you also told me that you were Miss Dockside. What's that about?
In the community where I lived, there's a little ice cream shop that is down in the harbor. And there was an old woman who worked there. Her name was Rosa Johnson. I scooped ice cream for her all through high school. And every year Rosa had orchestrated with some of the other shops down in this neighborhood to have this little parade. And she asked me to be Miss Dockside, where I would dress up in sort of a ball gown and we'd ride through town in an old convertible and I'd wave and
sort of like
flowers.
The rhododendron queen.
Yes.
A different take on it. Wow.
Right.
Well, that's cool. Were you one of these kids who sort of knew all along what you wanted to be when you grew up?
I did have a sense that I wanted to work in social justice. I definitely knew that I would end up probably doing something like being a lawyer or maybe a teacher or social worker, somewhere in there.
So where did you go to school?
After high school, I went to Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon.
Back to the West.
Back to the West Coast, and loved living in Portland, got a great education at Lewis and Clark. I majored in history. My college career really did prepare me to think critically about issues in our society that I wanted to be part of and work on. And so after college, I became an AmeriCorps Vista volunteer down in San Francisco, working for the San Francisco Unified School District, working on social justice issues in public schools in San Francisco.
Can you give us an example of one or two things you did with the school kids?
My job was to start after school programs in a part of the district where there were no after-school programs. The idea was that we wanted to create these after-school programs to help provide more support structures so that over time, their test scores would improve. And even though we weren't doing things like traditional academics, we were providing safe spaces for homework. And we were also providing safe spaces to develop other skills. And specifically, the programs that I'm most proud of are we started a food bank where the students themselves ran the food bank each week, and they partnered with the San Francisco Food Bank. Part of that was a component that had to do with cooking and cooking healthy foods. And the students were in charge of a lot of those lessons. And that was amazing to see. I also started an after-school art and drama club where we brought in local artists. San Francisco is known for a lot of their murals. And so we had one of the nonprofit agencies that does a lot of the mural paintings come in and do paintings with the kids and then did a big performance for a play. And then the third one is we did a TV show on Access SF, which is the local public television station in San Francisco. And the students wrote and produced and directed all of their own shows. I was the one adult sort of supervising them, but they came up with the topics for the shows. And it was amazing because all the students who participated really excelled having sort of these structured forums where they could apply their talents and see the results. And it would have this ripple effect where then they'd be more engaged in school in their regular classes during the day.
Okay. And you said you did that for a year?
I did.
And
yes.
Then law school was next?
Law school was next. So the AmeriCorps Vista program was only a year. And during that time, I was very successful at my particular program, but also ran into a lot of red tape. And I realized that, quite frankly, as a young woman, I just wasn't going to be taken seriously unless I had some credentials. And so I started looking at what kind of credentials do I want and which ones are going to give me access to where I need to go to continue to advocate for the causes that I want to advocate for. And so at that time, it became very clear to me that a law degree was pretty versatile and would give me that skill set.
So how did you pick which law school to go to?
Having been working in the school with the San Francisco Unified School District, I was very interested in education issues. And within the realm of education law, there's a couple areas that you can go into: child advocacy, working with cases where children are being taken out of the home due to child protection service issues, where the home is unsafe. There's also issues of education law, where students aren't getting the proper needs met at school, and working with school districts to make sure that those education needs are being met. And then there's also what's called the school to prison pipeline, where students are being disciplined at school and then ultimately ending up incarcerated. So those three issues, I wasn't quite sure what my path would be, but I had identified that I wanted to learn more about those. And a school in Minnesota called Hamline University School of Law had a particular focus on children's issues. And so I knew that if I went there, I would get the training I needed to address those different topics. And so I went there for that program. They also had another program within the university that was called the Dispute Resolution Institute. And you could graduate with your law degree as well as a certificate from this Dispute Resolution Institute that focused on advocacy and problem solving outside of the traditional adversarial system. So things like mediation, arbitration, really looking at conflict resolution prior to litigation.
Okay, and how did you like the winter in Minnesota?
Yeah, it was cold. I will never forget my first semester of law school, my first set of exams, lots of high pressure, you know, your first year. And I went outside to go to school to take the exam, and my doors had frozen shut. And I panicked, and I was on the street corner, and it was so cold outside. And I think my neighbors could see that I was having a little bit of a mini meltdown. And they came running out. They said, just pour water on it. And so that was when I learned that if your doors are stuck because they're frozen shut, you just pour water and then they open.
It's a useful tip.
Yes.
Useful tip. Okay. You're listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 on the radio dial or kptz.org online. The show's Our Town, and I'm the host, Marianne McNellis. Our Town profiles some of the complex, fascinating people who live and work on the Olympic Peninsula. Today, my guest, Ariel Spesser, who's a lawyer with the Northwest Justice Project. Ariel, before we get started on your career there, can you explain a little the concept behind the Northwest Justice Project?
Certainly. So the Northwest Justice Project is a nonprofit public interest law firm that does civil legal aid. So what that means is we represent low-income individuals and families. We represent them for free. We help them with any type of civil legal need issue that they might have that's within our priorities. It's like being a public defender, but for everything non-criminal.
Okay. How did you hear about this organization?
I had always wanted to practice public interest law. And during law school, I had interned with several agencies that are like Northwest Justice Project, but out in Minnesota. So when I moved back to Washington State, because the bar exam that you take to get your attorney license is state specific, I knew that I wanted to be here in Washington. And so I started looking for what agencies here in Washington offered these types of positions. The Northwest Justice Project was one of them. It is a statewide agency, and it is the largest provider of civil legal aid. So we represent the most clients directly.
How many lawyers are there?
We have a total staff at Northwest Justice Project that's about 100, and that includes all of our lawyers, legal assistants, and admin executive.
And you have multiple offices?
We do. We have 17 offices that are around the state. Most of them are very small, maybe even only one or two attorneys, but they are throughout the state to cover as much geographic area as possible.
And where are you personally? originally based?
Our office is in Port Angeles, and there are two attorneys and one legal assistant, and we cover Clallam County and Jefferson County.
I see. So anyone from those counties who had a civil issue could get in touch with you.
Exactly.
And I believe there's a 800 number, 888-201-1014. We'll repeat that towards the end of the show. But how did you manage to get hired there?
I feel very lucky. When I was in law school, my third year, I came back to Washington State to finish law school at the Seattle University School of Law. So I had started law school in Minnesota, but realized I wanted to come back to Washington. So I was doing my third year here locally so that I could make those connections.
Right, because you have to pass the bar in the state you want to practice in.
Correct.
Okay.
And during that time, I had coffee with a woman who is a staff attorney at the Northwest Justice Project. And I had told her about me, about where I'm coming from, the kind of work I want to do. And she was very supportive and encouraging and told me about her work. And at that time, I was just trying to understand how Northwest Justice Project worked, what kind of cases did she have? Did she like working there? And so she sort of, we call it an informational interview where you take somebody out to coffee. And so she was very helpful. After I had graduated law school, I saw a position come up at Northwest Justice Project and I applied and I was very lucky because coincidentally that same attorney was on the hiring committee.
Oh, just coincidentally. <that's handy.
laughs> And it was great because she was able to tell the other people on the hiring committee that I think this young woman is sincere. She was very interested a year ago and she's still very interested.
That's great. Did you get hired for the first position you applied for?
So I did not. I applied for a child advocacy position, but this particular position required you to be fluent in Spanish. And I am not bilingual. Once I got to the final interview with our executive director, he was very kind and said, well, I appreciate your desire, but unfortunately we can't hire you for this position. We're so sorry. And of course I understood. And then about a week later, they called back and said, you know, we know you applied for this other position and we weren't able to offer it to you because you're not bilingual, but we do have this other position that we're hiring for that we think you'd be really great for. And if you're interested, we'd love to re-interview you for this other position. That was within a new foreclosure unit, because this was in 2011 at the height of the economic recession and the foreclosure crisis. And they had a position that they were trying to fill. So I ended up getting that job working in their foreclosure prevention unit.
Okay. Can you explain a little bit what actually you did? Maybe give us a case or two that you worked on?
Yes. I represented homeowners who were at risk of losing their homes to foreclosure. And I was on the front lines working with the banks, trying to negotiate workout options. At that time, Washington State had instituted a new law that provided some additional protections for Washington State homeowners. And this was a really interesting time and challenging because most of the banks that were foreclosing at record rates were national banks. And so we had a dynamic where we had to convince these national huge corporations and companies that they needed to comply with our little Washington State law that, if applied correctly, is actually very powerful and provides a lot of protections to homeowners, but the banks actually have to follow the law in order for it to save the home. So my job was to take those cases and to first represent clients and trying to negotiate with the banks. If that didn't work, then there was a formal mediation process that we would go through. And if that didn't work, then litigation. And one of our cases did go up to the state Supreme Court. So there is a lot of case law on these types of issues around foreclosure. One of my favorite cases that I'll share with you, though, is a case where I represented a gentleman who was very low income. The bank had given him a loan, but now was trying to foreclose on him. And when he sent in his what's called his loss mitigation application, which is essentially you're saying, here's what I can pay. Please don't foreclose on me. Please let me resume payments, albeit they might be smaller payments at a reduced rate, but let me make these payments. The bank was saying, no, you don't have any income. We can't verify your income. We're just going to foreclose on you. And so they're sort of steamrolling ahead. And the homeowner is saying, but I do have income and I can make these payments. And so I got involved and I was looking at this gentleman's information and I thought, well, the truth is you haven't really documented your income very well. What is it that you do? And he explained that he collects scrap metal. The first barrier that I had is that the bank didn't want to acknowledge that that was a legitimate source of income or a legitimate source of employment. And I had to work very hard to help them overcome that stigma.
So how did you do this?
I went around to all the different places where my client scrapped metal and exchanged metal and actually got receipts, which was a bit of an investigation process. I felt like a private investigator going around, but it was great because every place I went to that he had identified, the people there said, oh, of course we know him. He's been coming here for years and he comes here on a weekly or biweekly basis. And they gave me receipts and they documented it. And then I was able to help the client create a profit and loss statement showing that he's self-employed and documenting his income. And this was a big deal for this gentleman who's fairly uneducated and had never had to make a profit and loss statement and didn't Right. know how to do it before. And so here I am helping him do it. And we do it together and we present the case. And at the end of the day, the bank and the mediator who was involved were all quite impressed because it turned out that this gentleman was doing quite well and was in fact a very successful scrap metaler. And at the end of the day, he did save his home.
Wow. So they took it as a real independent entrepreneurial job, right?
Yes, that's correct.
That's a great story. Oh, I'm glad that you managed to save some homes for some people. So how long did you do that particular job?
So I worked in the foreclosure unit from 2011 to 2016 when I switched titles and came under a new grant funding source called Victim of Crime. And so now technically my title at the Northwest Justice Project is Victim of Crime Advocate. And I represent victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and consumer fraud.
Okay. Can you give us an example of maybe one of each if we could?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll start with consumer fraud. That has to do with unfair debt collection practices most of the time. Certainly it's a broad range, but a lot of times, especially now in today's world, there's the original debt collector who you owe money to, but then there's a debt buyer, and that debt buyer has bought the right to collect from the original debt collector. But that debt buyer, that industry is booming, and they aren't always following the proper laws and procedures and doing their due diligence to make sure that they have the right to collect, or that the amount that they are collecting is correct, or that they can collect, that they are collecting in a timely manner. And there's a lot of violations that go on there. So that's the consumer piece that I do, is protecting vulnerable Washingtonians from unfair debt collection practices. The sexual assault piece comes up when it's either an individual has been sexual assaulted or a child has been sexual assaulted. And I will represent the protective parent on the civil side of things, protecting them and the children from the abuser. And so usually what that looks like is it might be helping somebody get divorced in a protection order.
Well, how do these cases come to you? Do some of them just come floating in the door, or do you get referrals? What happens?
So some of them do certainly walk in the door. Some of them come through our CLEAR hotline, which is what you, the number you referenced earlier.
Right.
And that hotline is statewide, and it works sort of like 211 works in a bigger city, where if you are in an emergency situation, you can call 211, for example, and they'll connect you to all sorts of emergency agencies. Here, we don't have 211 out in Jefferson County, but you can call the CLEAR, and that stands for Coordinated Legal Education, Advice, and Referral Hotline. And then you'll be able to talk with somebody. They'll say, where are you? What's your issue? Okay. And then they'll be able to refer you to our office with an intake, so we know and are ready to hit the ground running. Okay, this happened. Here's how I contact the person. Here's what they need. The third way is from our local domestic violence advocates. We have some great domestic violence agencies here in Jefferson County, the Dove House Advocacy Right. Services. And then in Clallam County, we have Healthy Families of Clallam County and also Forks Abuse Program.
I would imagine the hospitals also do a certain amount of referrals or provide people the number, something like that.
Yes. Yeah, they do. And the hospital has been a great partner, especially I will put in a plug for Charity Care, which is their program that forgives medical debt for low-income individuals. So we do receive quite a few referrals so that those accounts don't get sent to collections. But certainly they also refer for the domestic yeah. violence and assault yeah. as well, but they're very helpful.
Some of these cases must be very difficult emotionally for you as a lawyer to be sitting there and hear these stories. Some of them, I'm sure, are quite horrific. How do you handle the stress?
Yeah, thank you for asking. This is a question that I feel is near and dear to my heart because I worry about burnout for myself and for my colleagues. And it really is so true that we deal with secondary trauma in a real way. Personally, I have a very strong support network. I have a wonderful husband. I have great parents, support system, family, friends. I rely on them a lot to just say, hey, I've had a particularly hard week. I also have really great colleagues at Northwest Justice Project and within the advocacy community. And that's something that I value. And something that I think is really unique to Jefferson County is all of the advocates who I work with, we support each other. I can't tell you how many times I've been at the Dove House and I'm there representing a client. And then sort of at the end of the meeting, one of the advocates comes out and gives me a pat on the back too. And so it just means so much. We support each other because we know that the work is so hard. And we know that we first need to take care of ourselves so that we can take good care in representing our clients.
Now, you mentioned the other day that your husband is also more or less in the same business. Can you explain that?
Of course, yeah. His name is Nat Jacob, and he works for Jefferson Associated Counsel, which provides public defense for Jefferson County. So he is a public defender.
Right. We had Richard Davies on the show as well. And so they represent the criminal side of it and your organization, the civil cases. Did you ever think about going into a more traditional and perhaps lucrative area of the law, like corporate law?
Well, certainly it's tempting to think about it sometimes, but the truth is, no, I just have never really been that interested in it. I've always very much approached my work as an advocate, and I just feel that there's such a need for strong advocates doing social justice work. There's really a need to close what we call in my field the justice gap, to help people be able to access the courts in a meaningful way so that they can get the relief that they need and that they deserve. And I think there's such a need to keep those advocates in the field because we want to provide high quality representation.
But it certainly isn't a 9-to-5 job.
No, it's not. I work pretty much all the time. I regularly work into the evenings and additional hours.
I think you would have to. It's a must be tough, but I'm glad there are people like you doing work like this. We're running very low on time here, but I just wanted to briefly mention you're now on the Port Townsend City Council. Can you tell me why you decided to get into politics?
Of course, yes. I really wanted to run for city council to help represent, first and foremost, young people like myself here in Jefferson County. I think it's really important that we promote and support young people who live here and help them continue to live here through things like affordable housing and livable wage jobs. So that was a big concern of mine. The other equally important concern is I really wanted to help represent my client communities and help give them a voice, knowing their needs and understanding their barriers, and that thinking about when we go to make policy decisions, making sure that that voice is heard and making sure that that perspective is taken into account so that when we do create policies that they work for everybody, including the lowest income and the most vulnerable.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for being on the show. You've been listening to Our Town on KPTZ Port Townsend, 91.9 FM. I'm your host, Marianne McNellis. My guest today has been Ariel Spesser, who's with the Northwest Justice Project. For those of you who aren't too familiar with the organization, the lawyers at Northwest Justice represent many people who don't have enough money and desperately need legal help. As Ariel put it a bit earlier, they fight to close the justice gap. I'll give their phone number one more time, 888-201-1014. Thank you for doing this work, Ariel. Thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you so much.
I also want to thank my partner, John McPherson. He's the engineer and producer of Our Town. He makes me and my guests sound so clear and cool. I also want to thank Larry Stein, program director, Kate Ingram, station manager, and Robert Ambrose, chair. All three work long and hard to make KPTZ the best community station possible. And I want to thank you, the listener. Keep your radio or your computer hooked to KPTZ 91.9 FM for more dynamic, eclectic community radio.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production created by Marianne McNellis and engineered by John McPherson.